Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Dead Rock Stars with Mick Wall and Joel McIver.
Oh, I love that lady's voice. Here we are again. Welcome, everyone.
Is this now something you're going to say every time?
I wasn't going to do it every time.
Just the last couple of
times.
Yeah,
why not? It's a sexy voice.
Okay, carry on.
Welcome, everyone, to another...
I actually feel violated at this point. I feel I'm now part of Me Too because I'm in a room with a big, ugly dude popping his cherry.
Just imagine the beard tickle.
I mean, admittedly, I'm young and lithe, so I can see why you might go there, but please, yeah. Stop looking at Ian the producer. You and Ian the producer, you're his bitch. You're Ian's bitch.
Bitch.
Bitch. Fuck that guy.
Can we do it on Eazy-E?
Can you just get on with it?
Welcome, everyone. And here we go again for another epic episode of Dead Rock Stars. My name's Joel McIver and my dear friend Mick Wall is here. And today, who are we talking about? Mick?
We're going to be talking about the one and only Jimi Hendrix.
Now, that is a large subject, is it not?
It is. It is. I you know, let's put our cards on the table. We're not going to cover it in one, as you put it, Joel, episode of this podcast.
In one fell swoop.
Yeah. But we're going to give our own impressionistic view. Now, let me start, okay? Let me start. Straight off the bat.
Yeah.
You know, my generation definitely could well be different for yours, but my whole life, you say, who is, in your opinion, the greatest guitarist of all time?
Yes.
Everybody of my generation, with the exception of Jimmy Page, because Jimmy Page says he never saw Jimi Hendrix play live. Everybody says Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
Now, Joe Bonamassa actually told me that he's more of a fan of Eric Clapton than he is Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, yeah.
I get that. Not on a technical level because I don't play guitar, but I get it in terms of that's his own personal...
Yeah.
I don't think it means he thinks Clapton is the greater guitarist, or maybe it does, but you see where I'm going with this. So I'm going to ask you, in all honesty, and you actually play an instrument, don't you? And the guitar. Is Hendrix the greatest rock guitarist of all time?
I spoke to Jack Bruce about this. He'd played with both guys. I said, come on, Jack, you know, in your opinion, as an expert virtuoso on your instrument, who is the greatest player? And he said something which makes total sense, actually, which is that Eric was the technical master. He had the actual techniques of playing much further evolved and better, you know. Hendrix was this firebrand. It didn't matter what his instrument was. It so happened that he chose to play the guitar. So the guitar was a total expression of his personality. Yes, he used a lot of simple pentatonic scales, right? So he wasn't what we would call... We talked in earlier programs.
You've lost me. Pentatonic
scale. No problem. It's just a simple five-note scale that people use in blues. You know, it's not a complex scale. It's where you start, and you can make great music with pentatonics. You know, your friend Joe Bonamassa would tell you that. But it's not a super complex approach to solos.
Yeah, listen.
But this makes sense what I'm saying, right?
Steve Vai is super sexy, complicated.
A perfect example,
But he didn't write Purple Haze.
Right. So
what I'm trying to say to you is...
It's technique over artistry.
Are you talking... Is that how we judge these guys on technique? Because if the guitar playing is an expression of their true character, then I would venture to say that Eric is a pretty boring guitar player, whereas Hendrix has to be the most exciting, evocative, sexual, dynamic, psychedelic, funk, guitar god. He didn't have to think about it, he was it.
Think about the excitement that surrounds Hendrix's playing. Of course, Clapton doesn't measure up. But if you and I had been at the Flamingo Club in 1965 when he was playing with John Mayall, perhaps it would have been different. You know, the walls are sweating, you know, people are going crazy, it's 100 degrees. Clapton is there playing stuff that has not been played before. So maybe that's where his excitement comes in.
Is he playing it with his teeth?
No, he isn't.
Well, or behind his back?
It's an old blues trick.
Tricks of the trade.
You pretend to be doing it with your teeth when you're actually
playing. Are you saying
it.
Hendrix was miming?
Yeah, he didn't play it with his teeth. This is a well-known old blues trick. He did play behind his head, though, that's for sure. But what you can do when you've got a heavily distorted guitar sound is you can sort of do a hammer-on with one hand. You don't actually have to pick. You can sort of go... and it sounds like you're playing.
So you could just do that?
Well, you could, frankly.
No, but I couldn't.
To get back to the core point,
oh yeah,
you got Eric Clapton, this sort of polite chap, playing these wonderful, subtle blues licks. No, I mean, some of that early stuff is, look at Cream, man. There's nothing sedate about Cream. And no matter what happened later on with the Royal Albert Hall and all that stuff, which I know you're thinking of, right?
No, I'm thinking of Sunshine of Your Love.
It's a wonderful song. That's a great song, man. Hendrix, on the other hand, was this firebrand, you know. Are you going to keep doing that? It's getting it on. Different
Come
styles.
On.
Chalk and cheese.
Godhead. Mm. School teacher.
Slow hand.
Slow hand. There you go.
Do you know the solo in Sunshine of Your Love? The first line is the melody from Blue Moon. It goes...
Does that explain... I wondered why it was so boring.
The idea was to contrast sun with moon.
The first line of Hendrix's solo from Purple Haze was formed from the tears of an angel while roasting in the hell of desire, while tripping on a hydra-headed god-devil hybrid.
I've always thought this,
while shagging.
The sheep
for America.
Of Satan. Right, yeah, look. Yeah. So, okay. No, perfect expression of the man's
personality. Simple yes or no. Is Hendrix the greatest guitarist ever?
Yeah. I'm just going to say yeah.
Okay.
Where else does it start and finish?
Because all kidding aside, I don't know.
No, but this is not about technique, so you do know. This is about the artistry and the songs and the presence and the performance.
Yeah, and let's not forget, he was playing it upside down.
Yeah, he was. But, you know...
With the wrong hand.
He was among the first to use a heavily distorted guitar tone, that kind of...
While tripping on Owsley Acid. Let's not forget that.
The real stuff.
The real stuff.
Tell me, Owsley Acid was your special, strong, laboratory-produced acid, right?
If you talk to connoisseurs of the lysergic acid...
Experience, yeah.
They will tell you that there hasn't actually been any real acid since the Owsley acid of the 60s.
This was the legal stuff, right?
It was still legal,
yeah.
And therefore you were able to perfect the formula.
Yeah.
There was no kind of dash to get it done and flog it. It was done purely for altruistic purposes, which was to tune in, turn on and put on that Hendrix album and never come back. But it did become illegal, and of course, like all these things, it becomes corrupted, pirated.
Diluted.
Fucked. Mm. Can we say fucked?
If you say it in an Australian accent, yeah.
Fucked! Kind of fucked, mate! Or, as I like it in LA, fuck you!
Dude.
Fuck that guy!
It's like totally fucked.
Like, fuck that acid.
It's interesting about acid. I have no interest in ingesting the stuff, but what a huge psychosocial experiment that must have been for that. You know, decade or two of people who took it on a regular basis.
And I'll tell you what else, in terms of Hendrix's music, I mean, Lemmy, of course, was Jimmy's roadie for a brief period, and Lemmy told me that his main job, this is in the days when I think there were two roadies and Lemmy was one of them. You know, this is the days of package tours where your overhead is very low, one guitar and a bloke to help you drive the car, you know. He said his main job for Jimmy was to score acid every day.
Yeah.
He said he would score four tabs for Jimmy and one for himself.
God.
And they just do them every day. Now, the thing with acid is that the more you take, it's accumulative. If you were to take four tabs of Owsley acid right now, I fear we would never...
I might not survive.
I think you would, in an evolutionary sense, you would metamorphose.
Right, I like that.
Like Kafka's big insect thing.
Right, brilliant,
You know? Whereas Jimmy, it probably just a mild buzz. You know?
All right.
No, more than a mild buzz. And the thing is, his music truly did reflect that. And, of course, the era of stereo had just come in.
Yeah,
so you get
right.
What would now be considered incredibly cliche and corny, that wow, from speaker to speaker, you know, in that speaker and in that speaker. And don't forget, if they had four tracks to record
quad,
on,
yeah.
That was considered...
Ah, sorry, right, yeah, not quad, but a four-track recorder.
Yeah, this is pre-quad. Mm. This is pre-stereo, to be honest.
Yeah.
But the minute they get stereo, they're doing what any kid would do in a toy shop and using every effect, which in those literally was, you hear it in that speaker, then you hear it in that speaker.
Panning from left to right.
Yeah, yeah. These days you'd be going, what the fuck?
Dead Rock Stars. Memento Mori from Momentous Mortals.
I guess you can't discuss Hendrix without discussing the era, right? I mean, we've done this a few times in various podcasts, but it's endlessly fascinating. Let's quickly look at his life before he came over here and exploded onto the scene, and we can use that expression with Hendrix, I think. I always love the stories about those guys, Clapton and Townsend and the rest on me, saying, oh, yeah, we went and saw this bloke at the speakeasy or whatever, you know.
It was the Scotch of St. James.
Right, yeah, yeah. And they all walked out going, oh, fuck. Yeah. We really need to go and do something slightly different here. Anyway, so that's
squeaky,
the point we'll work
squeaky
toward.
Bum time. And it wasn't just the guitar. Mm. You know, I mean, you mentioned Clapton. I mean, all kidding aside, supreme guitarist.
Of course. Mm.
But look at Clapton on stage. I mean, barely moved a muscle in those days. Yeah, yeah. Jeff Beck, oh, he pratted around a bit. Mm. Townsend smashed his guitar, God bless Pete, ugly guy, big nose, and mainly bar chords.
Right.
And Hendrix comes on, this black cat making his bones.
Astounding looking bloke.
Incredibly good looking, truly far out, and those words meant something.
Yeah.
And he's playing the guitar upside down with his eyes closed and his brain clearly fizzing on some other planet.
And it's a wall of distorted sound as well, right? It's not your polite little blues tones.
Plus, every woman in the place is literally melting. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no women in there talking about pentampic ambiating four-chord triplets. Or, I say, is that a version of Sleepy John Estes's early blues classic from 42 brought up to contemporary standards? They're going, I want to fuck that guy!
Yeah, yeah, right, right, right.
Fuck me! We will have babies and go to Mars!
On acid.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah.
Cool. So we will come to this point.
Yeah.
Right then, as we know, he was born in 1942 in Seattle, am I right? Seattle?
Yep, yep.
Had a slightly juvenile lifestyle as a teenager, which
had
led
him... Had a slightly juvenile lifestyle. Yeah, I probably had an adolescence at some point.
What I meant to say was a juvenile delinquent lifestyle, and I just missed out the word delinquent.
Well, I mean, he came from like so many of our great dead rock stars, came from what these days would be considered a broken home, a dysfunctional background. But as I always add at this point, so did so many other people. Mm-hmm. They didn't turn into what we're going to say is probably the greatest guitarist of all time.
Right on.
His father was in the army, went off in the Second World War, didn't come back, then did. Mm. His mother had a pretty checkered personal history in terms of how to put food on the table.
Yeah.
Very kind of typical for the times. Mm-hmm. But you get this guy who becomes as so many of them do, this kind of prodigy, I should say, on guitar, goes into the US Army. Now, I don't know this off the top of my head, but it was like, and it isn't this, okay? So don't mail going, you get your facts wrong. You know, it was like the 5th Airborne, you know, the 7th Airborne.
I think it's something airborne, isn't
something,
it?
Yeah, definitely something airborne. I once interviewed, I think it was Buddy Cox who was in there.
Billy Cox, I think.
Sorry, Billy Cox, of course. Buddy Miles, Billy Cox.
Yeah.
That's where he met Jimmy at an Air Force base.
Yeah.
And he met him in that way you can just imagine. He said, I could hear this cat playing guitar.
Right.
Where's that coming from? He said, and it was Jimmy. Mm-hmm. So he got his bass. And according to Billy, he says a lot of the stuff that we now remember Hendrix for, a lot of those early tunes.
Yeah.
He was playing back then.
But that was not what he played as a career guitar player for the first few years.
No. I mean, that's like saying you were a music journalist on a magazine for 5 years and then you wrote a novel.
Sure.
You know, I mean, he's trying to earn money.
Yeah. So what did he do as a session guy?
He played with anybody that would pay him. Mm. So most famously, people like the Isley Brothers.
Right.
People like Little Richard. You know, if you go on YouTube and look up some of these clips, these days, of course, they'll come up with the original black and white clip and they'll put a white circle. He's in the chorus line.
Yeah.
You know, some of these bands would have like four guitarists and three saxophones, and there he is in his great haircut, his suit. But that grin, that great shit-eating grin of his.
Was he in New York at this point?
I think he played all over the United States. The Chitlin Circuit, they called it.
Yeah, of course.
Down in the South, segregation.
Was he paying his bills then as a respected guitar player, you know?
He was paying his bills, not as a respected guitar player.
Just another
schlub.
A schmo.
I think Ernie Isley was very influential on him. Ernie Isley, wonderful, brilliant guitar player.
Yeah.
But essentially, you know, don't get in the way of the star of the show. I mean, Little Richard wasn't about to say, now, check out the guitarist. If Hendrix had broken stride and tried to steal some of that spotlight, he wouldn't be doing any more gigs after that night. But he ends up on his travels back in New York, which in those days was the absolute epicenter of the music business in America.
It's the historical place that I would love to have been at most, you know. Never mind the West Coast.
Right.
I would love to have been in Greenwich Village when all that was kicking off.
Well,
with Dylan, you know, and the rest of them.
Absolutely. The Iggy folk scene, the what we now consider the early sort of underground punk scene, whatever.
Put a date on this?
Oh, 65.
Right.
And it's around this time he makes, infamously, I'm going to say, he records some tracks with Curtis Knight, who then later puts out, when Hendrix becomes a big star, puts out an album, you know, Curtis Knight and Jimi Hendrix.
Curtis Knight was a soul singer? Or
he was a good singer. He was on the circuit, and Jimmy was paid the going rate to come in and play, but he had to sign a bit of paper, which effectively worked as a contract. And was presented to Jimmy as such after he became a star. And part of the get-out was that they allowed Curtis Knight to put out his album with Jimmy's name plastered all over it. And then Curtis Knight spent the rest of his life telling Jimi Hendrix stories, including a book. But that's par for the course. This jobbing musician who is not remotely famous.
Still is par for the
course. He's just this... Exactly, exactly. The fateful night happens at Café Wire in New York when a young lady named Linda Keith watches him play. And like all young ladies that watched Jimi Hendrix play, she literally just, her mind was expanded.
Was he playing the sort of fiery stuff that he became famous for?
I imagine so. I mean, I wasn't there, but it wasn't that he was in a band. He just got up and, I mean, it was a Café Wire, these sorts of places where at 2 a.m. jobbing musicians would just come in and get up and do a bit, you know. But A, of course, he's amazing looking. B, he's left hand and he's incredibly far out guitarist. Linda Keith at that time was the girlfriend of Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones.
Wow.
It's weird to think of now when we think of Big Keith, the bad guy, but very insecure and paranoid about Linda, worried that she would go off and get off with other guys. And sure enough, her and Jimmy,
guess what happened?
Sparks flew.
Get away.
And she tried to just persuade whoever was to hand to come and see this amazing guy. And the guy that she manages to twist the arm of is Chaz Chandler, who until very recently had been the bassist in The Animals.
Yes.
Who'd been big in America with House of the Rising Sun, had toured, Eric Burdon had gone on and had a great career in America.
Yeah.
But Chaz, by this point, has left the group. He's had enough of the dreadful touring conditions you had in those days. The Animals are kind of past their peak. Eric's career is taking off. And Chaz, to cut a long story short, sees Jimmy as his ticket into another career, which is management. Through Chaz, Jimmy is brought to London.
All right.
He literally turns up with a guitar, comes in, and I think that night, that very night, because everybody knows Chaz, and London, the music business is tiny in those days.
Does Chaz deserve all the credit then for Jimmy's entree onto the scene?
You could say Linda Keith does.
Right.
You could say if Jimi Hendrix wasn't Jimi Hendrix, no one would have given a shit anyway.
Sure.
We all need a helping hand. You know, this is a recurring theme. Luck has to come into it, happenstance.
Yeah.
But if Jimmy couldn't play the way he played, no one would have paid any attention. It was just one of those weird anomalies that in his own country, no one gave it stuff. I mean, in fairness, you know, a young black guy plays amazing guitar.
Yeah.
Every town in America has about 10 of those. You know, this was not particularly extraordinary. We're also talking 65. It's not virtuoso rock at this point.
No.
So comes to London, and literally blows everybody's mind.
So the word had got out through Charles Chandler and his people. Well, that it this wasn't, was the it, man it, to see.
It wasn't even so much that he just turned up. You know, he just turned up at club and said, "Do you mind if he gets up and does a couple of numbers with you?"
Okay. Yeah, he did that with May All I Know at the Flamingo.
Do you mind if he gets up and has a blow?
Can he sit in?
Exactly.
That was the phrase, wasn't it?
And they'd be like, you know, dunga dunga. John Mayall would be.
Well, he'd be doing some old blues number, wouldn't he? Yeah. From, frankly, the 40s or something.
Yeah,
you know?
Dusty Sherlock right. and his many merry men.
His many lemons.
Something he did on the lemon farm in Mississippi.
Squeezed lemon.
1923. And we're going to amp it up for you. Unga-gunga-gunga-diddle-dee. Do you mind if Jimmy has a blow? Sure. Ow! Every woman in the place.
Oh, my word.
I want to fuck him. Every man, let's be fair. I think it's very telling that Jimmy Page insists to this day he never saw Hendrix play.
Why is it telling?
Well, because every other major guitarist, all his best friends like Eric,
yeah.
Jeff Beck, who he was in a group with at the time, you know, John Lennon,
yeah,
you know,
right.
Every guitarist in Britain
knew
about Jimi Hendrix within 3 seconds flat. I saw Joe Satriani, must have been 87, I think, when Surfing the Alien came out. You remember it, don't you, Joel?
I was there.
I was there. Were you there? Really?
I was there.
Yeah, I was there.
No.
Okay, I was there. I think I was the only guy there that couldn't play guitar. I didn't know anybody had ever heard of him.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
I got to the marquee and the queue went from the front door of the marquee all the way up Water Street, all the way down Oxford Street. And I thought, Joe Satriani clearly isn't playing tonight.
Yeah.
Led Zeppelin have reformed, you know.
Yeah.
And I swear to God, Joel, every fucking guitarist that you could name in the scene in those days was at that show.
Right.
This is Joe Satriani, God bless him.
Yeah.
Jimi Hendrix. Are you telling me Jimmy Page didn't go, oh, yeah, I think I've heard of him. I might pop to the Scotch of St. James or perhaps the Speakeasy. Or Jimmy, would you like to come and see Hendrix? Oh, no, I don't think so. No, I don't think there's much to learn there. He was so blown away.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the guy he is, where he just will never admit. Jimmy's the great denier. You know, he still says he's never read my book. You know, Jimmy still denies that he ever had any trouble with, you know, magic and drugs. You know, I mean, Jimmy, this is how he operates. This is his modus operandi. I just think it's really interesting that, you know, nearly 50 years after Hendrix's death, Jimmy Page can't say, I saw him. He was great.
I wonder if Blackmore saw him.
Oh, of course he did.
They diminish your point, yeah.
Joel, it's like saying, I wonder if they ever heard Bob Dylan sing.
Okay.
Do you think they'd heard of the Beatles?
The Beatles.
I mean, there you go. Yeah. Of course they fucking did.
All right. So this thing happens.
Yes. And
it explodes onto the scene.
And Chaz gets him in to do a single.
No, we had the Experience formed at this point.
Yes. I mean, but they were formed... These two guys are just hired on to play at the session.
Noel Redding, Mitch Mitchell.
Yeah.
Chaz put this together, right?
Well, they had a sort of open audition. I mean, Redding was a guitarist who couldn't get a gig. So they said, look, because he had an Afro haircut, that was his entree into the Experience. Not because he was a good bass player.
At first.
Well, no.
I know.
He was a white man with an Afro. Hendrix, I hadn't seen that before.
Right.
So, okay, well, we don't need a guitarist. Thanks.
Yeah.
But how about bass?
Yeah.
Mitch Mitchell, fantastically percussive player. Him and Ainsley Dunbar kind of ruled the roost. Dunbar always claimed that he was in the frame for the gig as well.
I'm going to say slightly average musicians, the Experience, apart from Jimmy. None other than renowned humanitarian and warm-hearted chap, Ginger Baker, made this point. He said that...
Ginger Baker slags off everybody.
He does, but the context here is that you had these two trios, did you not? Cream and the Experience.
And let me guess, Mitch Mitchell wasn't as good as Ginger.
Well, no, but that's not an outrageous claim to make, because Ginger's one of the greats.
Doesn't mean Mitch Mitchell wasn't one of the greats.
No, I'm just saying he was a perfectly decent drummer. We've had this conversation about Lars Ulrich, haven't we? Yeah. Perfectly decent drummer.
Hang on. We can talk Ginger Baker, we can talk Mitch Mitchell. I don't think we can throw Lars Ulrich in there. Let's be fair.
No. Yeah. I quite agree.
Yeah.
Anyway, the point being that this it was an interesting scenario that came up a few years later. You had these two power trios. Actually, there was some interesting statistic. All of the Experience died before any of Cream did. Why did it interest me? I don't know. It just did.
Is it because you're a nerd? You were probably sitting at home listening to Greg Howe.
Great guitar player.
Thinking of the greats of the
guitar.
He
was at the Speakeasy. No, he wasn't. He wasn't born. All right, good.
No one even knows who you're talking about.
Greg Howe. Okay. Mick's become obsessed, everyone, with Greg Howe. Great guitar player.
Joel's the one who's obsessed. So, anyway,
so
Hendrix.
The experience formed, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Could have been anybody. Happened to be those two.
Got it.
But it worked. Cream was virtuoso musicians.
It was.
Clapton, Bruce, Baker, mm-hmm. you know, the three gods of drums, bass and guitar. Mm-hmm. Jimi Hendrix was guitar, and Noel Redding had to keep the fuck out of his way. Mitch Mitchell, I thought, did a brilliant job of keeping up.
Yeah, exciting drummer, actually.
I mean, John Bonham, for instance, yeah. I think would have been a disaster with Jimi Hendrix. Mm-hmm. I think in Mitch he had a really percussive sort of lead drummer. Ooh. And I think what you don't need is someone like a Ginger Baker coming in and saying, well, I'm part of the mix here. You know, I think you need to listen more
we
to
need
me.
To feature the drums.
Yeah. I mean, I've got this thing called Toad, okay? and Hendrix's like, hey, man.
I'm not sure that's going to work, man.
Later, man. Hey, have this. It's called Owsley. You take that and lick that toad,
we
Ginger.
We should actually point out how much of Jimmy's music was incredibly mellow and sparse. As well as the sort of firestorm of rock.
Wind Cries Mary.
Right. Anything. You know, he played bass on Wind Cries Mary.
Yeah, he played bass on a lot of those tracks. In fact, you know, that goes into another point. The time you get to Electric Ladyland, his third album.
Magnum Opus.
Double album, final album released in his lifetime. Mm-hmm. He's playing loads of stuff on that. But he's also got Stevie Winwood. Nice. He's also got Dave Lombardo? Dave Grohl.
The producer's saying something. Say it.
Dave Mason.
Of he's Traffic.
Got, yeah, he's got Stevie Winwood, yeah, he's got Dave Mason. Some of those tracks that he was recording in New York at the record plant, Eddie Kramer, the producer, told me that they would set the stuff up in the studio in the evening because Jimmy would go out in the evening. He said, but you knew about 2 a.m. when the bars closed. He said it was like a carnival. Hendrix would lead people down the street.
No,
do you want to come and have a blow, man? He said, and you'd have to have all the stuff ready to go. You didn't know who he was going to turn up with, but you knew he would turn up and immediately want to jam.
Oh, God, imagine witnessing that.
And this is one of the reasons we have these enormous vaults of material.
Yeah, yeah.
The man never stopped playing,
no.
Except for when he was fucking. And the man fucked a lot of women, a lot of chicks, as we said in those days. I mean, I'm actually writing a book about Hendrix for the future. Kathy Etchingham was his London girlfriend, his main squeeze.
Yeah.
Chaz Chandler lived on the top floor of a building in London with his girlfriend at the time, later his wife, I think. Jimmy and Kathy lived on the ground floor.
Yeah.
When they weren't fucking, they were fighting. But Kathy really took good care of him. I interviewed her for the book. Wonderful, wonderful woman, full of fantastic stories.
Yeah, that's good.
But of course, Jimmy is Jimmy, and he goes on the road, and, well, he doesn't even have to go on the road. He sticks his head out the door. There are women everywhere.
Let's jump back to the time of the first album. Are you experienced? Right. Was he already like that? Was the profile that big?
Oh, yeah.
Well, he
records a single, Hey Joe.
Yeah.
That becomes a huge hit.
Great song.
Well, his version is now the definitive version, but of course, many versions exist. It's a very old song. And his first original song hit is Purple Haze, which is the next single. Talk about a 1-2 punch.
And encapsulating the vibe of a generation, I guess.
And then there comes the album, Are You Experienced? Which is a great title as well.
It's wonderful.
So that comes out.
Edgy, actually. It's a progressive.
Beautiful album. His second album, for many people, is still his best.
Axis,
Boulder's Love.
Same year, 67.
Because in those days, that was what happened. I mean, Hendrix didn't book time at a studio to make an album.
Mm-hmm.
Hendrix went in whenever he wasn't doing anything else and made music.
Who was he signed to?
Track Records, which was a label put together by the Who's then managers, Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp.
Yes.
Part of Polydor. And it was a deal done literally at the bar at the Speakeasy with Chaz, who they'd known for Donkeys. These are the days of sign this on the back of a
Serbia. Back of an envelope. Right. When did the experience become the Band of Gypsies?
They didn't become the Band of Gypsies. He shed the experience fairly quickly.
Yeah. So Billy Cox came back into the picture.
Billy Cox, Buddy Miles. The whole crew of people. I mean, the famous footage of them at Woodstock, Rainbow Bridge, that era. Mm. This was Hendrix, some have argued since, this was Hendrix sort of reclaiming his blackness.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
And he made some amazing... I'm thinking of one track now, Freedom, which is so funky, yet such a powerful rock song.
Yeah.
And yes, it doesn't have that busy percussive flurry and energy that Mitchell brought to the drums. It's much more funky, and at that point Bonzo probably would have fitted in. The bass, you know, Noel Redding was a white guy who didn't play bass but did a nice job with Hendrix. Suddenly you've got a guy who can play bass and really play.
And really keep up with Hendrix, actually.
And you've got percussion and keyboards and anything else.
It's a whole step up, wasn't it?
But commercially, it didn't fly. You know, it wasn't a huge hit. Mm-hmm. And these are the days before Zeppelin, before the Stones have really metamorphosed into an album band.
Yeah.
The idea of a rock artist, pop artist, rock artist, having a career that lasted more than 3 years...
Yeah.
was a huge gamble, unless you were the Beatles.
Well, they were running out of steam, right?
They were gone by 1970. The point is, you know, Jeff Beck was in the Yardbirds, then he had his own group. Yeah. Rod Stewart was in the Jeff Beck group, then he was in the Faces.
Yeah.
You know, the groups came together and split up all the time.
Yeah, like Cream. They only had, what, 2-3 years?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then Blind Faith, one album.
Right. I've heard from various sources that Jimmy didn't like his own voice. Any truth?
Eddie Kramer says Jimmy didn't like his own voice, which always surprised me because I love his voice.
God, it's a beautiful, soulful voice.
It's perfect, isn't it?
Really, yeah.
But after Eddie told me that, I went back and listened to some of the early records, and I guess what it is Jimmy's idea of a singer.
Yeah.
Don't forget the tradition he comes from, where you've got some of the greatest singers that ever walked
and
the earth.
Motown and Stack stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay, well, so in context, that makes sense.
And now you hear Jimmy doing this almost kind of spoken word thing.
Yeah.
Hey, Joe, where you going? It wasn't like, hey, it wasn't like Dio, was it? It wasn't, hey, Joy.
I can't think of a singer that Jimmy was less like than Ronnie James Dio.
He was a superb vocalist.
I think so.
Character singer.
I wouldn't even say he was a bad singer. Maybe like Bob Dylan in that respect, you know, the man, or John Lennon. None of these people were amazing singers, but they had emotive voices that conveyed what they wanted to say.
And speaking of Bob Dylan, let's not forget, Hendrix was a supremely interpretive artist.
Fuck. Dylan songs, he made them his own, right? Even Bob Dylan said he made them his own.
Yeah, well, when Dylan subsequently went on tour, he was off, he didn't tour for many years. When he came back and toured with the band in the early 70s, when they did All Along the Watchtower, they did the Jimi Hendrix version.
I didn't know that.
Not the acoustic version that Bob had recorded on John Wesley Harding.
Good Lord.
Beautiful song. Mm. But Hendrix took that woodshed and turned it into a cathedral. Mm. And Bob utterly copied that. In homage, because that was the definitive version. But also the way he sings it, you know, two riders were a punch.
Oh, God, and the production as well. When that song starts with the kind of echoey, amazing sort of wash of those guitars, it just takes you away. What an evocative song.
And Eddie Kramer deserves huge credit for being there to record all these things.
Yeah.
But the real credit has to be Jimmy, because Eddie's a great producer, but I never heard anything he did after that came close. But then I never heard any other rock artist do anything that came close. The point I'm making isn't to denigrate Eddie, who did a fantastic job, but to point out that the genius and the reason we love All Along the Watchtower is because of the way Jimi Hendrix breathed life into it.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Dead Rock Stars with Mick Wall and Joel McIver.
Tell me about Electric Ladyland. Mm. We've talked about the other records, not particularly this one. I mean, this is his landmark album.
It is for me. As yeah. I say, for many people, Axis, Boulder's Love is the definitive album because yeah. I guess it had a coherence,
yeah. Yeah.
an impact that it's very hard to better.
Mm.
What I loved about and still love about Electric Ladyland was that it was much more freeform.
Yeah.
It was closer to jazz, if you like.
Yeah.
And it was also made in New York. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of it was made in New York, whereas the others were made in London.
Has that amazing cover art, which itself was a statement, right?
Very 60s.
Still amazing.
Very 60s, yeah. at a time of sexual liberation.
Yeah.
This
yeah.
is freedom. Mm. This is a whole new world we're talking about, where hang-ups about women's breasts yeah. and all this business.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, at the same time, I'm sure in that sort of what we now characterise as the Spinal Tap mm. way, I'm sure Hendrix just thought, wow, it's really sexy.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah,
he was
yeah,
a really yeah. sexy guy.
Yeah, didn't he get his cock immortalised by Cynthia the Plastercaster along with...
Well, Cynthia Plastercaster immortalised many people's cocks.
Yours?
But what was extraordinary about
Yours?
Jimmy's, obviously, what was extraordinary about Jimmy's and mine was that, what was extraordinary about Hendrix's, according to Cynthia, is that he maintained an erection
throughout. He stayed tumescent.
Because once you apply,
yeah.
you have to sit there for like 40 minutes
right,
while
right,
it sets.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And the big problem she always had was that no one could ever keep going that long. Because you can't even apply stimulus because you've got all this stuff around it. Apparently,
yeah,
Jimmy, sort of, not a problem.
Managed to stay standing.
You bet. Oh, yeah.
It's incredible, really.
Yeah.
I think about 40 seconds I might have a problem with all that cold crap all over the old chap. That's amazing. We'll have to try it sometime. Live on air.
Let's not. Right. So, I don't know what we were talking about.
You were saying that in a Spinal Tap way, he was like, man, this is sexy cover.
Yeah, Electric Ladyland. Yeah, I mean, yeah. at the same time, you know, you have this idea of Jimmy had become friends with Miles Davis.
Yeah.
In fact, he'd stolen Miles Davis's wife. Well, stolen is a terrible word.
Inherited.
In the 60s, it would have been, me and your
Liberated.
Old lady, we're together now.
Yeah.
That was Betty Davis.
We're grooving.
Betty Davis.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Betty loved Hendrix, turned Miles Davis onto Hendrix.
Yeah.
That was when Miles stopped wearing the suit and tie and started wearing
the
far out clothes.
Dude, we have to do Miles Davis at some point because his electric era is just mesmerising.
Well, Miles was deeply influenced by the Hendrix experience, no pun intended.
Right.
Because, as I say, it was this free-form thing. Live,
we're
talking complete improvisation, spontaneity, never the same two nights running. Betty introduces him to Jimmy. Miles introduces Jimmy to what Miles says is the best coke dealer in town.
You must
promise me you'll never buy your coke from anybody else because this guy's the man. And Jimmy adhered to that. Jimmy, meanwhile, is completely absorbed by this jazz genius.
Yeah.
And it's no coincidence on Electric Ladyland you start getting these 8, 9, 10-minute tracks which don't seem to have a particular beginning, middle or end. They just kind of happen.
They flow, man.
They flow. Miles actually decided he would try and form a band with Jimmy.
Oh, my word.
And this was the beginning of what we now call jazz rock.
Yeah.
So Miles Davis has Tony Williams, a young, far-out drummer who ends up having his own band Lifetime. Hendrix is supposed to be part of it.
Mm.
But, of course, Hendrix was also not the most reliable guy. Did Jimmy say he would be here at 7 on a Tuesday?
Right.
Why, it's Saturday at 5 and here he is. Oh, he's gone again. So, in the end, Miles drafted in John McLaughlin.
Right, of course. Yeah.
Another masterful guitarist coming out of jazz but fully into rock. And that becomes the basis of...
Bitches Brew.
Bitches Brew.
Yeah, Dave Holland on bass.
In a Silent Way.
Yeah, yeah.
All these incredible moments which are happening at the same time as Hendrix is doing Electric Ladyland, forming Band of Gypsies.
Yeah, right.
You know, you see it all coalescing into a certain pattern.
Right, right. At this point in his career, was Hendrix coherent, functioning well? He wasn't off his face on acid all the time?
I think he was pretty off his face most of the time. I mean, it was a popular pursuit to spike him. You know, which was something that went on a lot in the 60s.
Horrendous thing to do.
On the other hand, you know, Jimmy had something in common here with Bon Scott,
The sort of the guy who tried everything first.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah,
give it here, man.
Was he into smack?
Oh, I definitely would have tried it, yeah. Mm. I mean, all the great music. I mean, Miles Davis was a terrible junkie for many years. Not by the time he meets Hendrix.
Right.
Dylan was. Mm. Keith Richards. Mm. Eric Clapton.
God.
Eventually, later on, Jimmy Page and people like that. Mm. You know, this is around a lot.
Sure it is, yeah.
But for Hendrix, it was overload.
Yeah.
You know, acid was the big thing.
No, but he wasn't. Sorry to butt in. He was not, as so many of our previous subjects have done, he was not describing a slow downward spiral into sort of darkness and doom.
No.
He was creatively, commercially, personally firing on all cylinders, right?
Well, I think the man was in need of a rest. He was pretty torn and frayed by
because
the
management worked the fuck out of him.
They worked the fuck out of him. Not only that, though, but they kind of tore apart his dream, you know? Mm-hmm. The band of gypsies dissolved. Mm. They tried to get the experience back together because that was the commercial ticket in the US.
Yeah.
You know, he ends up playing these god-awful festivals in Norway or Germany or something. Yeah. Uli John Roth famously took his cue, as it were, from Hendrix in his own career, told me that he was at that festival and one in Germany. And he said, it was incredible, he said, but Jimmy really did look like, not a ghost, that's too dramatic, but clearly was operating on fumes.
Sort of his last leg. Right, flying on, fumes. Yeah, okay.
So all by the time you get to London, you've got this guy who isn't a happy bunny, but nevertheless, as long as he's still playing, you know, that's his get out of jail ticket, you know, that's his one true love.
Yeah.
One of the people we haven't mentioned, which we should, looms like a dark shadow over this period because he was the main reason why the band of gypsies kind of didn't carry on because they weren't making the kind of dough that this guy wanted, which is Mike Jeffrey. Mm-hmm. Mike Jeffrey was another guy from the Animals who'd rumoured gangland links up in Newcastle in the northeast where the Animals were from.
This was never definitively proven or
remained rumours? The thing about Hendrix is there are so many, so many stories that people deny, swear by, hard to verify because it was a long time ago and records just weren't kept. It was such a nefarious lifestyle.
No.
If he'd had Brian Epstein managing him, a lot of this stuff would have been a matter of record, but he didn't. He had Mike Jeffrey, who flew by the seat of his pants, but Chaz brought in because Chaz wasn't an experienced record biz manager.
Yeah.
He was a musician.
Mm.
And so he brought Mike in to handle, you know, the business.
Yeah, yeah.
But Mike couldn't believe his luck when Hendrix just took off like a rocket. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not talking about, they're like Pink Floyd. They've had this hit and they're going to do an album. You know, it was, I've discovered the new Beatles.
Yeah.
You've really, really hit the jackpot here. This guy's extraordinary. And so Mike, as was the way in those days, particularly for someone like him, saw it entirely as a short-term proposition, make as much money as you can while you can. Mm. And if anything, a bit like Colonel Tom Parker and Elvis, the minute Hendrix started showing any sign of moving beyond that very narrow ka-ching arrangement, Jeffrey did everything he could to stymie it.
Did Jeffrey ever talk publicly about this, you know, about trying to steer Hendrix's career insofar as you could?
Not to my knowledge, no. Yeah, I mean, he was a deeply... this guy didn't give interviews.
No.
I mean, he was... eventually died in a plane crash.
What, in the 80s?
No, early 70s. Mm. He died pretty soon after Jimmy died. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there are all these rumours that Jeffrey was behind Hendrix's death.
Well, we'll come to that. It's the biggest conspiracy theory of all, I guess, right? We'll come to that momentarily.
Certainly one of them.
OK, so we've talked about albums that came out in 67 and 68. Then you've got 1969, and then you've got 1970, which was the year he died.
Mm.
Where was he going in that last year and a half of his life?
Well, that's the $64 billion question. Mm-hmm. We can only surmise. The fact is he was making music every day, practically.
Sure. Yeah.
Recording, laying it down. We speculate.
Sure we do.
And it's very hard to... No one knows, but my feeling is, you know, you look at his association with Miles Davis, Hendrix in his own career, and after he died, you know, his reputation was becoming as big as a Stockhausen, you know, was becoming as big as classical experimental composers.
Yeah.
He was definitely up there. I mean, Eddie Kramer told me that he believes Hendrix would have gone more into movie music, soundtrack music, and that may well have been the case. But
right.
for me, I think yeah. that's a kind of a cod way of saying instrumental, evocative, not 3-minute hit songs.
No, no, I'm thinking of people like Stanley Clarke, right?
Yeah.
Who came from a jazz rock world and you know, ended up making incredible soundtracks.
Well, you could easily have seen Jimmy making an album with Stanley Clarke.
Very, very easily.
You know, if the whole thing hadn't been so fucked up, you could have. I'm sure Miles Davis and Jimi Hendrix would have made an album at some point.
How
wouldn't that be amazing?
Would it have been just a bit, yeah.
Everybody wanted to work with Jimmy. Everybody wanted to get a contact high.
Yeah, right. Nicely put.
And I think that when it comes to Hendrix, because we talk about Beyond the Sky and the other side of the rainbow and that, it's very hard to say anything without sounding trite and punning.
Sure.
But. You know, the sky was the limit. It really was.
Yeah.
And the whole thing about his death, we could do a whole podcast purely on the night he died.
We could.
But there are many, many conflicting stories. Some say it was drugs. Mm-hmm. He got sick in his sleep. Others talk of evidence of him being pumped with red wine.
If there was a coroner's report, what did it say?
Well, we mentioned coroner's reports a lot, don't we?
We
you
do.
Know, you know I have
Sadly,
a very...
Sadly, we do.
I have a very low opinion of coroner's reports. I don't know off the top of my head. Someone will write in and let us know. But it was a typical misadventure.
I think aspiration of his vomit is a kind of known thing.
Asphyxiation.
Well, yeah. They talk about aspirating your own vomit and asphyxiating on it. But what led to that, I guess, is the question, right?
Well, there are people saying he was still alive when they got him to the hospital. There were people saying he was already dead. You know, Monica Daneman, who was his girlfriend, and then eventually spent the rest of her life with Uli John Roth.
Yeah.
Was convinced that, you know, it was a conspiracy to kill Jimmy by Mike Jeffrey.
Right, so talk about that. And now, a few years ago, you were editing a Hendrix special for Classic Rock magazine, and you asked me to review a book written by James Tappy Wright, who had been one of Hendrix's roadies. And in Mr. Wright's book, he said very clearly that Jimmy had been murdered, not, I believe, by Mike Jeffrey himself, but by his people.
Mm.
By pouring, I don't know, 3 bottles of red wine down his throat until he vomited.
Mm.
I can't remember the exact details, but like maybe choking him while he vomited or just ensuring that he did not survive the vomit.
And I think his assertion was because Jeffries had him insured for a lot of money.
In order to make a lot of money out of the insurance money that he would get from Jimmy not fulfilling his obligations as a touring artist. Right?
I think also he'd reconciled himself, if that's the word, to the fact that Jimmy wasn't going to be doing his bidding anymore.
I mean, this is a huge claim to make. Now, Mike Jeffrey was long dead when this book came out.
Mm.
James Wright himself has subsequently died.
Mm.
And he was very, very clear in his book. He said, this is what happened. Mm. I think he cited an eyewitness whose name I can't remember. But he said, this is what happened. Jimmy was murdered for an insurance claim. Now, what do we do with that information, you know, all these years later?
Well, we do know that just a few months before that, Jimi Hendrix was kidnapped in New York.
Tell us about that.
Which, again, people attribute to Mike Jeffrey, although this kidnapping was allegedly done by members of the Mafia, who, it is said, some say, on Mike Jeffrey's bidding. Now, whether it was to scare the bejesus out of Jimmy... But shortly after that, he embarks on his experience tour. I think he was gone for like 3 to 5 days, something like that.
Mm.
And, of course, you know, the media coverage of such things is so minimal in those days compared to now.
Yeah.
You can't look out the window these days without it being all over social media.
Yeah.
Hendrix kidnapped for 5 days. But, yes, it happened. And, yeah, it freaked the shit out of everybody.
This is all proven and known.
Yeah, absolutely,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I didn't just make it up. What? Stop looking at him.
Wait, he's going to say something.
Here we go.
So his stomach was pumped full of red wine, but he hadn't had time to metabolise it, which is why there was none in his bloodstream.
According to the surgeon, Dr. Bannister, he said that Hendrix's body was full of red wine.
His stomach was full of red wine.
Absolutely overflowing with red wine.
But
the alcohol content in his blood was minimal.
Right, so therefore... The wine cannot have been in his stomach very long.
Right.
Before he died.
Right.
And he stated that Jimmy must have drowned from this.
Right. And,
so,
and Tappy claims that they shoved gallons
bottles
of this
stuff
down his neck. Yeah.
And it's consistent with Tappy's claim. That's what the surgeon thought. So maybe Jimmy was murdered. You know, maybe he was.
I think people overlook or simply aren't aware of just how dodgy music biz and showbiz was.
Oh, man.
In the 60s.
The list of monstrous managers goes on and on, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and organised crime, particularly in America, remains a feature, if truth be known, but particularly in those Wild West days where people aren't pulling out credit cards for tickets or records, they're paying cash. And these are usually poor people making the records. They're not smart cookies. Hendrix had been running around like the runt of the litter for most of his life. Now he's a big star. It could just disappear tomorrow, you know. And the way he was spending money and people were spending his money for him, I mean, Hendrix never owned a house.
Really?
Never owned a house, never owned a car. You know, he would sleep on the floor or someone's spare room, or he'd have an apartment briefly in New York with some chick. Him and Kathy in London, I think, was the closest he ever got to domesticity. And even that was, you know, a young couple having a good time.
Going back to the night of his death, Monica discovered him, right?
That's how the story goes.
Lemmy maintained that she was at fault for not putting Jimmy in the recovery position.
Right.
Which may or may not be relevant. God, Lemmy would know. Oh, Lemmy was, on an unrelated note, Lemmy the following day was going to go and audition as Hendrix's bass player.
Wow.
What a fantastic thing. That's what Lemmy said.
Lemmy was such a fibber sometimes.
You're right, but he was saying this in the context of a very sad story about Jimmy's death, so I imagine it wouldn't be the time to throw in a kind of a quip, you know what I mean? You know, you were talking about these terrible management, these people who have people beaten up.
Yeah.
You know what blows my mind is co-writers who will sit down with them, work with them on their books. I don't understand how people have the moral interpretude to do that. Anyway, moving swiftly on from my friend Mick. All right, so Hendrix is gone. What was the reaction among the...
Sorry, I think that kind of passed me by there. Are you having a dig?
No.
Fuck you! Fuck that guy!
Asshole. Hendrix died.
Yeah.
The reaction from the world at large?
It's always reported that, you know, shockwaves, you know, sent around the world.
Exploded through the scene.
I don't know if they did. I mean, you look at the press cuttings and yes, it's a splash, particularly as it's London. But nothing compared to... Probably when Brian Jones died.
I was just going to say Brian Jones, right? Yeah.
No, it absolutely caused a shock. But we lived in times when, you know, I think Janis had gone.
Sure.
Jim Morrison was on the horizon. People died.
Dead rock stars. Dead men can't sue.
Fantastic, Mick. All right. I mean, God, what a huge subject to try and squeeze in at 45 minutes. But we've had a shot with great affection. And we normally, do we not, end these things by assigning a mark out of 5 stars for the subject at hand.
This is going to be easy.
Well, I kind of think it is. We normally talk about the star quality, the influence, the taste for excess of these people. I mean, is there any idea that this is going to be less than 5 stars? For any
these are all 5.
You know, Jimi Hendrix, you know, Jimi fucking Hendrix.
He kind of wrote the rule book on taste for excess and what are the other ones?
Star quality.
Image. You know,
his image.
Influence. Legacy. No Hendrix, no us.
Wow, man. You're saying he's your father. You heard it here first. Death is a career move. Right. I mean, he's one of the 27 club. I fucking hate that expression, but it kind of does make sense. 27 years old.
Well, he's kind of the exemplar of death as a career move because the man released in his lifetime 3 albums.
Yeah.
And since then, there have probably been 300.
Right.
And some of them have been very good. A great many have been awful.
Yeah, yeah.
Not because he was awful, but because they were clearly cash-ins.
Should have stayed in the vault.
But the fact is, you know, we're talking, I was going to say Che Guevara. You know, it's beyond that.
Yeah.
You know, I often mention James Dean. This is beyond that.
Beyond just being a musician.
Yeah, I mean, I think this goes beyond just the old he died young thing. There's something Christ-like about Jimi Hendrix in musical terms.
Yeah.
Because his message of love.
Yeah.
People talk about John Lennon's message, which was also very important. Jimmy's, I think, though, was more all-embracing. You know, Lennon definitely knew who the baddies were. I don't think Hendrix really knew who the baddies were. I think he lined up with the devils and the angels. And I think they all worshipped him, except for those ones that couldn't stand it and wanted to kill him.
Beautiful, man. All right. Now, how do we get from Jimi Hendrix to our next dead rock star?
Jimi Hendrix was a parachutist in the US Army, and such a skill could have saved our next dead rock star's life.
Nicely put.
Like Hendrix, our next dead rock star mixed up blues, soul, hard rock, jazz, and funky grooves chopped it all into a line like and snorted it.
Like a gumbo of music.
According to Greg Allman, Hendrix was a big fan of the next artist's band. Mm-hmm. And like Hendrix, our next dead rock star enjoyed just 4 years in the spotlight before his untimely demise.
Yes.
There's a phrase you don't hear often.
No, you don't. Well, everyone, thanks very much for listening. Share the heck out of this podcast, and we will see you next week. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
That wasn't your usual Judas Priest-like
waffle.
Ending.
Goodbye!
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.